Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Brian Kastner, whose memoir is titled The Long Walk, A Story of War and the Life That Follows. Brian Kastner was in Iraq in 2005 through 2007, two different tours.
Two tours. I left just before the start of 2007.
You were in the EOD unit, Explosive Ordnance Disposal Unit, correct?
That's right. Yeah, the military, we use a lot of acronyms, and so I try to explain. But yes, EOD, it's the bomb squad.
Well, this book is a very harrowing book. What it does is it tells of your life while you were in the EOD in Iraq and leading up to it as well, and then your life afterward and how you adjusted or didn't adjust. And you don't give any dates. I did notice on your blog that the opening of the book, when you described that one day you felt crazy, that happened in 2010, February 6, 2010. That happened 3 years after you got back.
And I do remember exactly the day and the place and the time and the footstep and every little bit about it. But if I had put dates in the book, other than just general dates of when I went to EOD school, but if I didn't want the reader to feel like they had to keep track, like they needed a little tally. And really, the dates and the chronology, in some ways, the least important part, because of course I was writing the book as it felt, the narrative isn't straightforward. It doesn't just go one thing after the other.
What prompted you to write it? And had you been doing much writing prior to writing the book?
I'd been writing a little, and I had always wanted to be a writer, and I had always wanted to write a book. But for me, wanting to write a book someday was like wanting to visit China someday. Like if it happened to work out, then that would be great. But I had no specific plan. And certainly when I was in Iraq, I wasn't writing notes to be used for some book later. I wrote a little bit for an alt news site in Buffalo. Buffalo, New York is where I live. And I had written some for that. I wrote a little piece for Newsweek when I got out of the Air Force and moved back to Buffalo. But I didn't see writing as a catharsis or as something specific that I really wanted to do. I wrote the book because I had to eventually. I had something inside of me that needed to get out. But I didn't see it as a solution to my problems, so to speak. It was more like I was taking all of these notes at the urging of my therapist when things were getting really bad. She said, well, why don't you seem to do better writing things down. Why don't you write some of it out? And the more I wrote and the more I did, I realized, hey, maybe there's a story here somewhere that other people might be interested in.
Were you writing it chronologically as we read it in the book?
Oh, no. I was writing it scattershot. I was whatever particular thing was bothering me most or most on my mind is whatever I wrote that day. And then I spent plenty of time in between writing episodes just trying to get the order right and making sure that it all felt right. The first chapter I wrote was the chapter about Kermit, you know, for instance, which is in the middle of the book.
Afterward, it was kind of editing. Did you have any help in trying to put the pieces together?
I did that mostly on my own. And when we sold the book and the editing process, we didn't really move anything around. And in fact, my editor made a point of saying, hey, let's keep this structurally as it is. The editing process was maybe 5%, 2%. We did little tweaks. We added in a little bit more about my wife. We added in a little bit more technical detail about in some of the combat scenes just to give a better sense. But no big major structural changes at all. And that was my fear. I felt like I was getting away with something a little bit. First time writer, and I'm writing a very non-traditional kind of book.
Yeah, but it was an intuitive thing.
It was. I was doing it however it felt right. And my goal always was if the reader feels like they're coming along for the ride, even if that's disjointed and claustrophobic, well, that's how I felt.
Well, let's talk a little about this book, Brian Kastner. Okay, you applied for EOD school, what, in 99 or something? Or?
I graduated college and got commissioned in 1999, and then I applied to go to EOD school in 2002. So I had done another job in the Air Force first.
What were your politics like at the time? Did you think much about the fact that, you know, you were going into the Army right after 9/11? Where were your politics in 2002?
In 2002, I think I was caught up in the same patriotic wave as most of the country. You know, I got my ROTC scholarship in 1995. Very different country, very different political situation, obviously. I was in the military for almost 2 years before 9/11 happened. And then there was just this really intense need to do something about it. And I felt a lot of purpose, like I was in the right place at the right time to be able to serve my country. And I went to EOD school, in fact, during the invasion of Iraq. And if you remember, in, you know, mid-2003, the war in Afghanistan had gone very well. You know, we cleared almost everybody out. We met almost all of our objectives almost immediately. 2002 was kind of quiet. It was about the build-up to Iraq. And it was more of a feeling of, well, I better get to Iraq while I still can, because that's going to be done too.
So you completely bought into whatever propaganda about the need for invasion Iraq.
See, now that's funny, because when I was in Saudi Arabia in 2001 when 9/11 happened, and my job was to help people defend against chemical attack. And so we were teaching people to wear their gas mask, and we were running these chemical detectors, and the threat was clearly Saddam Hussein and his weapons. And this was long before there was any justification to go for war. That was well known throughout the military as just what the basic threat was. I didn't feel like anybody was trying to convince me. I had read the reports the same way lots of other people in the military did.
And then the invasion happened, and you were just itching to get over there?
I was, because I felt like, the military does a very good job of training you to do a specific mission or a task. And EOD school was so hard. It was such a draining mentally and physical exercise that all you really wanted to do was, well, now I want to do it for real. I've been trained to do this. Now I'd like to actually do it. And like I said, because Afghanistan had been so quick, obviously now we see differently, but it felt so quick. It was, hey, get to Iraq while you can. We'll be out of there in a year.
I notice you call it Iraq, and insofar as we know, people over there call it Iraq?
I don't know. I guess that's just – I don't know why I say that particularly. I say Kirkuk, which I think is probably a lot closer to the actual way they say it there, instead of, I've heard lots of different things for Kirkuk. So I don't intentionally say it one way or the other, I guess.
Well, the reason I'm asking is that you were over there and then you pronounce it Iraq, and that's how a lot of Americans pronounce it. And that it seems to me, maybe I'm wrong, that it kind of divorces you from what might actually be happening if you're mispronouncing the name of the country.
That's an interesting way of putting it. From actually having been there,
yeah.
I feel like the American narrative is very divorced as well from what's really happening there. Because at least, say, in Kirkuk in 2006, it wasn't about Sunni and Shia like you hear on some of the news.
Right.
It wasn't even about American versus whoever. It was about Kurds versus Arabs and a fight that they had been having for almost as long as there have been Kurds and Arabs. We happened to be stuck in the middle. But a lot of what was going on was independent of an American presence being there. And that's not a narrative you necessarily hear in the United States either.
When you went over there, I mean, the narrative from the Bush administration, of course, and Dick Cheney was that, you know, America was going to go in and they were going to be inundated by flowers. When you first got over there, right, did anybody tell you, uh-oh, watch out, this isn't exactly what's going on, or was it a case of your going out on your first mission and then seeing that, uh-oh, I'm not loved here?
What politicians say in commercials and at campaign stops and in the general media has very little to do with how the military views their job and how you train and how you prepare to go and do it. So our eyes were wide open about what the mission was going to be, what the hazards were, what the reality was, and it was extremely mission focus. When we first got there in Balad in January of 2005, the mission was to get the elections off the ground. It was the first free elections, that they had essentially had. And it was keep the populace safe so that when they're standing in line to vote, they're not being killed. And so you're not really listening to a speech about flowers. You're thinking very specifically about that task.
And you're not necessarily thinking, why the hell am I here? Because you've got a mission.
Because you have a mission. And this is also maybe a good point to say that with the guys that I served with, the conversation that we're having is not really a conversation that we had. Not because we didn't think about it, but because it was so much less important than the fact that I'm going over with this brotherhood of guys. Our mission is everybody comes home safely. It was doing the best you can for the guy to your right and your left, which is a cliche that we've heard for years about war, but it doesn't keep it from being true. And so people would talk once in a while, but I served with guys who supported the war and guys who didn't and guys who supported it to the very last day and guys who thought it was a terrible mistake. And none of it really mattered about doing the mission and then keeping everybody safe and bringing all your buddies home.
You mentioned guys. Were there any women in the EOD unit?
The ratio is about 30 to 1. So I did not have any women working for me in my two tours in Iraq, but back at home, at my stateside assignments, there would, about two in each unit.
There's now been a lot of information about rape and how women were treated in the military. Did you notice any of that in your tours?
I didn't, and it's maybe because the EOD community is so protective of each other that its gender roles are kind of seamless. Everybody has to do the same job. Women have to wear the bomb suit the same as men. Some guys are different, guys, girls. Airmen in general are better at maybe one task or another, but it's not really about the gender roles, and I never saw any of it.
Anything about don't ask, don't tell, or was that so completely foreign to what you were dealing with?
No, you know what? You may be surprised, but the opposite is that we had plenty of openly gay and open lesbian folks that worked for me, and everybody knew and nobody cared. And it had been that way for a decade.
Really?
For as long as I had been in, it was just not a big deal. Once again, the point is, you know, you're bonded with these people that you're deploying with. You know, I could really care less who has a boyfriend or a girlfriend instead of a girlfriend or a boyfriend.
Brian Kastner, that first time you were in Bilal, 1 month into it, you did something wrong and was almost court-martialed. But what you did wrong is that you acted on your own to deal with an issue that had to be dealt with. It struck me, at least from reading your book, The Long Walk, you did nothing wrong.
You know, I didn't want to be too cute about it or put myself up as blameless or anything because I knew what the rule was and I broke it. Just a little background, you know, we had to ask permission, request up the chain of command to be able to go off base at Balad, and we needed to get some robots fixed. I never heard whether we had permission to send this convoy to Baghdad or not, and I knew that we hadn't received permission one way or the other, but I sent them anyway. Striking off on your own to get a job done is kind of permissible, but within a certain framework, I guess. And I did step outside of those bounds, and actually I learned a lot about what rules you can bend and which ones you can break to really get the things done you need to.
Well, you were only there a month at the time, so.
Right, and it was my first trip to combat for real and my first chance to be in charge, and I was still, you know, I was still learning a lot of things.
Had you'd gone out on a couple of missions at that point,
though. I had, right.
And you'd already seen a little bit of what had been described to you in terms of how people related to American soldiers?
Yes, but there's an assumption in that question that there actually was a relationship with American soldiers. And in a lot of ways, it was just us in heavily armed vehicles with a lot of body armor and helmet on driving through the streets and very, very little interaction. And in fact, you know, when the surge happened in 2007, 2008, a lot of that was less about the number of troops that we needed, although they did send more, and more about the change in attitude, which is it's really easy to kill somebody that you don't know. And that's true in both directions. And so you need to get out of the vehicle and you need to get out and walk the streets and actually meet these people. And we weren't doing that before. We were just simply driving from place to place and we would see them through the windows of the vehicles.
So that happened after your second tour.
Right. Yeah. I never saw the benefit of the surge. I had two fairly hopeless tours where there was a lot of question of, things don't seem to be getting better day to day. What we're doing isn't working. What should we be doing different?
And so at a certain point, as you say in your book, your attitude changed from this is a mission to we all need to stay alive.
Right. And as I say in the book, the irony that the best way to keep everybody alive is to not go at all, you know, didn't really occur to me at the time. It really only occurred to me later. And it was the mission was 30 guys and gals go standing upright. They go vertical and they come back vertical. Nobody comes home horizontal and nobody comes home dead. Every day the mission was we go out, we do what we need to do, we take care of the IED, and we get back as safely as we can.
How long did the second mission happen when you went back the longer time? How long were you there, like 18 months? Or?
Oh, no, 6 months.
So you were there a month and then 6 months.
Correct.
And in that 6 months, that was enough.
That was enough. The lion's share of the vignettes from combat in this book take place from those 6 months.
During that 6 months, did you notice any change in how people viewed the war, or were you not there long enough to see that?
Things were, like I said, fairly hopeless in 2006 in that it was Groundhog Day. Every single day, car bombs went off, and every single day, somebody got blown up, and every single day, you know, all these terrible things were happening, and we never seemed to be making any progress. You know, not to disappoint, but it's not like we sat around the fire at the end of the day and then, you know, and talked the politics about it. You talked about cleaning your rifle and whether the robots were ready to go the next day.
And basically trying to get an hour sleep where you could.
Right, because you knew that as soon as you did go to sleep that you'd be waking up again to do it all over again.
Basically, you were alternating between moments of terror and moments of boredom.
Yes, and I've heard that is like a fair description of war for a long time, is that there's a lot of waiting. We didn't have that much waiting because the calls just came in so regularly. And then, yeah, your whole mission once you left the base was how quickly can I get back?
You're listening to an interview with Brian Kastner, whose memoir is titled The Long Walk. I'm Richard Walensky. The Long Walk refers to walking from a safe place over to where the bomb is to defuse it?
That's right. And it's our term for it. When the robot hasn't worked anymore, or you can't get to it with the robot, or you can't do some other remote procedure, eventually somebody has to put on the bomb suit and walk down there and take care of the IED one way or the other.
So basically you're sending out a robot or a person, and their goal is to explode the bomb in a safe environment?
That's kind of a last resort. What you'd really like to do is take it apart mechanically or with a very small amount of explosives so you can find the evidence, save the evidence. Every bomb in a road that you blow up just where it sits, well, you're just putting craters in the road and you're doing the bomber's work for them in some way. Or you're blowing up the school that it's sitting at, or you're blowing up the government ministry that it's sitting at. So you'd like to avoid doing that, and so that way you're not taking down the school.
What's the relationship between a movie like The Hurt Locker and reality? You don't mention it in the book, but you do on your blog.
Well, because I get asked about it, you know, regularly. And The Hurt Locker is Hollywood. There's a little bit in the beginning and a little bit at the end that's realistic, and there's a lot in the middle that's just not the realistic procedures of how we do it. I should say that actually I think the best part in that whole film, by the way, which was overall an excellent film, and who wouldn't want their job to be turned into an Academy Award winning picture there. But at the very, very end where he's just overwhelmed with American excess and can't figure out what cereal to buy, that part felt exactly right.
When you came back.
It did. You walk into the airport and who needs 72 different kinds of gummy bears, you know, and who needs that many different kinds of magazines and soda pop and everything else?
Brian Kastner, did you have any dealings with Blackwater or contractors?
Very little, in that we would see them once in a while, but our security was mainly U.S. Army or Marine Corps, those kind of.
And when you were there any massacres or violent fights going on elsewhere that you heard about through the grapevine?
The grapevine is a funny thing. So you heard plenty of things, but you learn to not necessarily believe things that you didn't see, especially because the most important things that were happening to you never really seemed to make the news. And for example, is there's a chapter in the book called The Day of Six V-Beds. A V-Bed is a vehicle-borne IED. It's a car bomb. You know, that was a very significant day for Kirkuk, and for months afterwards, we had two car bombs a day. It was a huge deal, and a lot of people died. And there were two lines in an AP news story that appeared in the United States about it, and that's all that anybody back here heard. So we just felt like the reality of the war that we were experiencing was so divorced from whatever the news media was, it was hard to trust reports from other parts of the country unless you actually saw it.
Did you ever make it to Baghdad?
I did, regularly.
Did you go to the Green Zone?
Once. That's an interesting place because Kirkuk, we were so far out, you know, you're in, you know, the wild, wild west almost. You're on this far end of the country. And then as you work your way in and the infrastructure grows and grows, there's a couple other military bases around Baghdad that did feel like what I was used to. But then I landed on a helicopter only once in the Green Zone. And everybody was wearing shorts and flip-flops. It just didn't make any sense to me. Like, whatever is going on here just didn't feel like anything else that was going on in the rest of the country.
So when you flew in, it was like coming into a different universe.
It was. It was like, where's everybody's rifle and their body armor? And, you know, it didn't look like... I don't know if it was a false sense of security or what. I was there on the helicopter pad for about 2 hours, and I got a quick bite to eat at the chow hall and had some of the best food I ever did while in country there, and then flew out.
And Kirkuk itself, is there any analog that we could look at, any film or something that would describe what it felt like to be there as a city?
Kirkuk is a city of about 1 million people. Very densely populated, not really with suburbs like we think about them in the United States. And in some ways, it looks like any other third world slum in that there is, you know, trash everywhere and everything is either dirt or concrete and it's nothing but taxi cabs and just kind of a mass of humanity. What's really different is not the city itself, but where it sits, which is in those oil fields in the north that are so valuable, which is what a lot of the Arabs and Kurds are fighting over.
And there's not much in the way of trees, greenery?
A couple eucalyptus trees that Saddam had planted around. There are those once in a while, but up by there, there's not even the palm groves and the date groves like there are around the Tigris and the Euphrates.
And the base itself that you were at, what was that, Quonset huts, concrete buildings, what was it?
It was the old airport, and so there were two runways, but I use the term airport loosely. And we were in... what's called a HAZ, which is a hardened aircraft shelter that the French had built for the Iraqis a couple decades ago, which was great. It had these great blast doors. But basically everybody else was in tents or, you know, trailers.
And did you feel safe?
I did with that 2 foot thick concrete over my head. So I slept like a baby when I could.
But when you went to the mess hall, who knew?
Right. Then you're just in an open building.
Well, Brian Kastner, you come back and, you know, the obviously culture shock is going to hit you. But 3 years later, something else hit you. You began twitching. You began feeling weird. Now, during those 3 years, you talk a lot in the book, The Long Walk, about feeling your, I guess, imaginary rifle next to you.
Right.
Were you feeling it in those 3 years or did it suddenly need to come back?
I guess once in a while, the day that it hit me, it was more like an accumulation of symptoms that had kind of come and go or would happen once in a while, just all built up and exploded all at the same time. Yeah, I did often feel like I was carrying my rifle with me. I'm not sure whether the feeling changed or whether it really started to bother me changed. And by bother me, I mean, you know, I'd been home for a couple years and I thought I had just kind of moved past whatever had happened. And realizing that it was all with me way more than it should have been is maybe one of the threads in that rope of the crazy. There's a lot of threads. It took me a whole book to try to figure out what all of them are.
When you got that feeling, do you still get it now?
I do once in a while. I do. I had a really good friend that died in January, going back for his funeral, kind of popped up again and said, you know, remember me? I haven't really left.
I mean, on the book tour, do you ever feel any of that, or are you feeling calm? Or
I feel generally Well, not quite calm. We're like, you know, excited and, you know, interested to talk to you or, you know, meet people and such. But it's easy on the book tour because I have a mission again. I have somewhere I need to be. I have something I need to do. And it keeps you present. The crazy comes in those times. It comes in the middle of the night when you're staring at the ceiling.
Is that one of the reasons why your writing has mostly moved toward nature, because you have to be in the now?
Becoming more present is definitely something that helped with it. A lot of yoga is about becoming present right in the moment, and I write about the yoga, and it's really helped me. I think the nature writing helps because it is objectively peaceful and it's objectively real, and it's things that would exist without all of our human impositions. It feels like not to get too philosophical about it, but you know, a lot of the conflict in Iraq was about distinctions that we human beings made. We drew some lines on a map and called them countries, and we make distinctions between races or whatever the case may be. And the mountain is real no matter what I call it. It objectively exists by itself, and I do feel very present while I'm hiking on it.
I noticed that your blog consists of long descriptions of nature. It's like, okay, here I am on Earth.
Right. Some of the blog is practice. It's me reading a new author and then trying on some of his style and seeing if I like it or not. And some of it is just what interests me. The politics used to interest me and the public policy used to interest me. And I used to watch the news all day long and I would always have MSNBC on in the background all the time or whatever else. And I just simply don't. Just the hurly-burly, it's always going to be there if you check in on it. But it never seems to change much, does it? So I've tuned a lot of that out, and I think that's helped in the most minor way.
Well, you know, I in my notes I wrote, what are your feelings about war, Romney, Obama, Iran, neocons, Fox News, and generals?
Right. Do you want me to answer that?
Well, I mean, you've pulled back from it, but I mean, put it in the context of how you're feeling now, I guess.
How I'm feeling now is that I can't believe we're talking about doing some of the things that we talk about doing. There are things that you learn in war that you really can't learn anywhere else. And now that I've learned them, I don't even like yelling at my kids. I'd like to think I'm a much gentler father, you know, for instance. So I don't know if warmongering is the right word or whatever it happens to be. I've tuned a lot of it out. Maybe that's once again for my own sanity. I think it would drive me nuts if I were in the middle of it.
So when you switch on that TV and you see all of this stuff, a lot of it just must seem like silly. Well, it's not silly because
no,
it's
extremely serious, right? But it's done so flippantly. I think the issue for me, what I really feel about the politics is that it has been completely divorced from the experience of the average soldier who's doing it. And the military has become so divorced from the average American culture. There's only a couple hundred thousand people in the military out of 300 million. Through the base realignment process for budget cutting reasons and political reasons, we've closed a lot of bases in communities and we've kind of consolidated down to Texas and North Carolina and a couple of bases in Southern California. And the average American simply does not see someone in uniform. They don't see them at the grocery store. They don't have a cousin that enlisted. It's families tend to do it and the average American is divorced. And if you don't know anyone in the military, it is easy to deploy that military. They're not your neighbors anymore.
When you got out, how helpful were veteran support groups, the VA?
The VA became helpful. I would not have made it to the right office myself. I went to the VA emergency room on the advice of my wife, who is an emergency room nurse, because this is when I thought I was having a heart attack with a lot of those crazy feelings. And she said, you know what, they're used to talking to somebody like you and seeing somebody like you. You should go there. And I eventually got referred to the right office, and I eventually made it on the mental health floor, which is probably where I should have been. I would not have found that on my own. So I guess you could say the system worked. It took a little while, But they eventually referred me to the right place.
And veteran support groups, have you gone to any?
I haven't really. In the writing of this book, the organizers of some have reached out to me as more like, you're welcome to our group anytime. And I guess I appreciate that. I've just never, I guess I just haven't tried it, and I'm not sure. I don't know. I have a veterans support group outside of the VA. It's all of my brothers and sisters who in the EOD world, and I know I can always call them on the phone and or see them.
Two things in the long walk that I knew nothing about. One is brain damage, TBI, traumatic brain injury. 20% of returning vets have this. It's, and it's not visible at all, and it isn't PTSD.
That's correct. And there is some research now where some psychologists are trying to figure out where TBI stops and PTSD begins. It might be a continuum or a scope of things. But there's just so much new research on this that a lot of it isn't set yet. But traumatic brain injury kind of falls into two camps. There's concussions, which people have known about for a while, and sports figures get them and everything else. And you can get that in the military because you get into a vehicle accident or you fall down and hit your head or something. But then there's this other insidious form, which is the blast-induced traumatic brain injury, which I have a very mild case of, and a lot of folks do. And it's when your brain experiences detonations regularly, things just rip and tear inside of there and affects everybody differently.
And you have some memory loss, right?
I do. Memory loss is a common thing, either some long-term memories or the inability to form new short-term memories. There are sleep disorders. There's fatigue disorders. There's a lot of non-specific things, but there's a laundry list now that they've tied to this.
Well, what's odd is that we go through all the crazy and all of this torment that you're going through, and basically you're told, hey, Brian, you're fine. And that must that sounds pretty scary.
Having the TBI diagnosis helped in that I felt like, well, at least some of these nonspecific things are attributable to something, but it doesn't fix it. It just gives it a label. And the label only puts your mind at rest so much. So, I mean, there were so many threads of the crazy. There were things that you might expect, like stuff I had seen in the war. There was the traumatic brain injury. There was the grief of my friends that I've lost. There was the realization that, I had a very good friend, Ricky, who only died once he got back. And I felt safe when I got back. And it turned out maybe you're not safe. Maybe you thought you returned okay, but you're not.
He's the one who died on a plane. Right?
He did. He had a massive aneurysm and, had massive flood of blood to his brain.
If you're allowed shock now, do you jump?
No, and those are the kind of things that just fade so quickly. And that's certainly the stereotype. Like, you can't watch war movies, you can't watch violent video games, whatever. It's not those kind of things that bothered me. It was just all the daily little reminders. It's not a loud noise. I think of my Humvee every time I hear a diesel engine because that's the rumble that was in my ear for, however many months that was.
Another thing that surprised me, and you go into some depth toward the end of the book, is what it was like to actually get in a helicopter or fly around where you're in dark, it's stinky, you're there for hours, bored out of your mind, and you have no idea if you're going to come down alive because you're in Iraq.
Right. I had a friend I gave the book to who was an English teacher in Connecticut and had almost no connection with the military. And one of his pieces of feedback was, he thought because from watching commercials or movies or whatever else, he thought that being in the military was like being in Halo, or we were all space marines with all of this gear and stuff. And he was completely surprised to learn that a lot of our equipment was from Vietnam and World War II, and we're just still using it. And that's certainly true for the helicopters.
And you were not necessarily weighed down, though the friend of yours who fell in the water was.
He was. So I had a good friend, Kermit, who they had engine trouble over a lake at the Haditha Dam, behind the Haditha Dam. And everybody started to get out because the helicopter's crashing, and he had all of his gear on, and so he sank to the bottom. And, of course, that's how I rode on every helicopter, is you ride with your rifle and your vest and your body armor and your helmet and the whole bit.
Brian Kastner, 2006, you sent in a letter to Doonesbury.
Yes.
Yeah, and
2 weeks after I got back, actually.
Really? Because I found it. I found it through your blog. And you make a comment. When someone says welcome home or thank you, I feel embarrassed or guilty. And this is a paraphrase. Embarrassed because my mission was more about survival than success. And guilty because I'm coming home and so many others are not. Do you still feel that way?
I do. And I hadn't looked at that little Doonesbury piece for years. And what surprised me when I read it again was how clearly I still felt all of the things then. And things that I thought I was discovering in the course of writing this book, it turns out I was rediscovering it. I captured it, you know, almost a lot of those feelings just, you know, just really stayed with me. Because I'm not sure if I don't have survivor's guilt. I understand guys who do. I guess I understand that war, like life, is random, and there really is no reason. There's no why me or why somebody else. There's no reasonable answer to that question. But I do feel like, well, why are you thanking me? I'm still here. You know, you should be thanking people who aren't here, or who you can't see because they've lost their legs and so they're in the hospital.
On the other hand, by doing what you did, you saved a lot of lives.
Yes, but I guess I have no idea how many, and I don't keep that kind of tally in my head. That doesn't bring any sort of comfort or closure or anything. It's going to sound totally, again, like cliche to say I was just doing my job, but you just go out and you do that every day.
Firefighters do the same thing. I mean, you were going out, and every time you defused a bomb, that was a bomb that didn't go off.
That's right. My grandfather was a firefighter, City of Buffalo firefighter, for over 30 years, and a man I greatly admire. When you fight a fire, you know, unless it's arson, there was some random event that started it, and you have the satisfaction of knowing that you pulled innocent people out. And hope, you know, there's the iconic images of you carrying some little 7-year-old girl out, right? I never carried a 7-year-old girl away from a bomb. I don't have some, like, beautiful image of my head of, I haven't personalized it to say, you know what, I saved this person. You just go out and you're being shot at and you're seeing the worst. You're surrounded by the worst of humanity, not all of this heroic bravery.
When you hear the story of a veteran who shoots up a Sikh temple,
right,
what goes through your own mind?
Three things. Obviously, empathy for the people caught in that who are being shot. A certain amount of fear or suspicion that, you know, there'll be some political agenda that will confirm some bias, either about veterans or guns or whatever the case may be. But then also a certain amount of, I don't know, frustration or I don't know the guy. I don't know the specifics. I mean, everybody's individual case is different. Maybe some people can't be helped. Why couldn't somebody have, you know, have intervened? But once again, you know, life, the answer of why me or why them or why then doesn't, you know, life is random and it's tragic, but it doesn't mean that there's necessarily like a great lesson or meaning that's, or prevention cure that's hiding in there.
Did you use real names in the book?
I did. Okay. And I agonized about that. Actually, it was a major topic of discussion.
And how does your wife and kids feel about the book?
I didn't let my wife read it until we had sold it because it was so personal that I felt like any critique of it was really a critique of me. And she has since read it, of course, and then she helped with some of the edits. And I didn't want to put words in her mouth, and so most of where she appears in the book is only after, you know, it's a result of edits afterwards. If I say she's come to peace with it, that's maybe a little bit too much. But she's very supportive of it. My kids, I haven't let them read it, and I'm not sure when I'm going to let them read it.
But you wrote at some point, I wrote the book for my children.
I did. They're 14, 9, 6, and 3. So I haven't decided how old they need to be. In my mind, when I say I was writing it for my children, which is true, it's some future 30 or 40 or 50 year old version of my children, you know, that's had life experience and maybe able to put it in perspective.
Brian Kastner, now you write a column for Buffalo Spree magazine.
Yeah, it's a local lifestyle magazine in Buffalo. I've been doing that for a little while. I'm not quite as regular as I used to be.
And you have your blog at briankastner.com.
That's right.
Have you started work on a novel or any other works?
I have. I've started on a couple. I have a couple outlines for future projects, and then I definitely have a next book I'm writing, which is nonfiction, but my agent and editor would kill me if I told you about it before I showed it to them. So we're in the very beginning stages.
Well, what do you think about anti-war activists now? Do you have any appraisal? Has that changed anything regarding Occupy?
I don't feel like I fit in with activists on either end of the spectrum. And either end of the spectrum doesn't really appeal to me. I think my view is a lot like I tried to write the book, which is even-handed and real and making sure that it felt right. And I'm not sure that the reality or the truth of the situation resides on either end of the spectrum necessarily. So I have more sympathy, I guess, for a more nuanced view that war is a terrible, terrible thing, but I'm not sure how we stop it. And it's going to continue for a while.
In your blog, when you talk about memoir, you kind of say that in your own mind, memoir has to be more specific and deal with the actual facts as opposed to what you remember.
I wrote a little piece for Publishers Weekly, which was about how I wish that the book weren't called a memoir. Like, that word just doesn't seem to fit. And I think because in my mind, I know memoir has had this revitalization and people are writing memoirs about all sorts of different things. But in my mind, it's still something that you do at the end of your life when you look back and everything is clear and the arc is exposed and you understand why everything happened, if there is such a thing. And then you write it all down and then you're done. You're free to die then because you've written your memoir. It's the last thing you do. And I feel like this is more like, this is just a story of something that happened to me. And it happened. Here's some stuff that happened to some other people, too. And there are a million war stories. And this one just happened to be mine. And, you know, I appreciate people reading it, and I was happy to share it. And it's extremely gratifying when people have an emotional reaction to it and want to talk to me about it. But it's really just my experience. And there are, you know, 3 million other books that could be written from all of the Iraq and Afghanistan veterans.
But it's also true, and this I've found in interviewing people over the years, that the more specific you are, the more general, in a way, you become, the more people are able to relate to you.
People are certainly people are coming up to me and want to relate. And that is an extremely, it feels really good, and it's a great compliment to say that here's my experience of what happened to me. And for some other person, for the reader, they say, well, from you explaining what happened to you, you just explained something to me in my own life. And I've had friends, you know, widows of you know, they've lost their husband, and they said, you know, something was going on with him, and I didn't understand what, and maybe now I have the slightest insight into what's going on.
And the gun is no longer next to you. And the foot is no longer in the box?
No, they're still there. I still think about it. When I parked my car and walked over to the studio and I needed to stop and look at my phone, I put my back to the wall because that's what you do. There's no cure for it. There's just putting it in its place.
You've been listening to an interview with Brian Kastner, whose book is titled The Long Walk, A Story of War and the Life That Follows. You can read his blog at briankastner.com. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.